morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, February 6, 2020. Minister of Health official says a suspected case of the coronavirus is under control in Juba.
A sample was taken from him and sent to South Africa. So there's no reason for anybody to panic. So he came just normal. He came without fever. He developed fever in South Sudan. Could be malaria, could be any other fever. Not corona yet. It's not confirmed.
And parties to the revitalized peace agreement meet for hours in Juba to talk about states and boundaries.
Together with security arrangements, these are the barest minimum. Without these two issues being resolved, we in the opposition, we in IO, we will not come into government. I repeat.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The director of Juba Teaching Hospital, Dr. Makair Isaac, says there are no confirmed cases of coronavirus in South Sudan. Isaac says one Chinese national who traveled to South Sudan on January 23rd was brought to Juba Teaching Hospital Wednesday with symptoms of flu. He says officials from the World Health Organization took samples from the patient for tests to determine his illness. Isaac says there is no cause for panic in Juba because the patient has been placed under quarantine until test results are out.
Yesterday morning, two people just walked into my office. One is a Chinese and the other one is South Sudanese wearing masks. So I asked them, why are you wearing masks? They told me we have a colleague of ours who came 10 days ago from China. He was fine and he started developing fever. I told them, okay, let him stay in the car and I will call the WHO team. And they responded immediately. They came and the patient was taken to the quarantine for a confirmation. A sample was taken from him and sent to South Africa. So there's no reason for anybody to panic. So he came just normal. He came without fever. He developed fever in South Sudan. Could be malaria, could be any other fever. Not corona yet. It's not confirmed.
How long does it take for you to get the results after you submit the samples for tests? How long does it take?
I think we'll receive it later today or tomorrow morning.
Talk to us about the level of preparedness at the national level. Is the country prepared to tackle this problem?
We are fully prepared. We have a team at the airport who are really screening patients who are coming from all over the world. And if anybody is suspected to have a fever or any sign of a fever or a viral infection, it will be taken for more investigation and then take a sample. And if it is confirmed it is a normal flu or a malaria, it will be released. So we are very fully prepared.
Talking about preparation, there were complaints at Juba International Airport that some VIPs, these are ministers, director general, undersecretaries, or people of higher status, that they normally don't go through the screening. They just jump into their cars and drive away. What is the ministry doing to, ensure that everybody is screened? Because it's not safe if some people are avoiding screening.
I'm not aware of that, but what we know, the instructions given to people at the airport, everybody who's coming from outside, in spite of your title or you are a minister or not, you are screened. Everybody is screened.
But
nobody is exempted.
Yeah, I've seen.
So I don't think this is true. It's not true.
I've traveled to Juba International Airport. Yeah. I've seen some VIPs that come out of their plane straight to their cars and they're driven away. Are the screening done in their homes?
Yeah, that was in the past, not now. We have a well-prepared and trained team at the airport who are very polite and they know how to approach these very, very high-profile people that they are screened. Even myself, I was coming one day, I was screened. And I know the people who are working there and they know me, but I was screened like anybody else.
Dr. Makair, the truth here is that sometimes it's very difficult to follow somebody who gets out of the plane straight into his car with bodyguards. I've seen it with my own eyes. In December, I was in Juba.
But there was no scare at that time. There was no team at the airport and the corona was not there.
But there was screening for the screening for Ebola is continuous.
Screen people.
The screening for Ebola has been continuous.
But now it's different. it's now different. You don't tell me where we screen everybody. Nobody's exempted.
Thank you very much, Dr. Makera Isaac, for giving us that important health information. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. My pleasure to talk to you. You're welcome always.
That's Dr. Makera Isaac, director of the Juba Teaching Hospital. He was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. The World Health Organization is holding off on calling the coronavirus outbreak epidemic, although some infectious diseases experts are saying it could lead to one. The virus has spread to more than 24 countries, although the vast majority of the cases and deaths have been in China. VOA's Carol Pearson asked experts experienced on disease outbreaks what they would do to stop this one.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention helped West African countries successfully end their Ebola outbreak a few years ago. At the time, the CDC was headed by Dr. Tom Frieden. He now heads a global nonprofit organization called Resolve to Save Lives. In a Skype interview, VOA asked him, "How do you end the coronavirus epidemic going on now?"
For each different microbe, we have a different approach. For some, we have vaccines. For some, there are containment measures like SARS or MERS or Ebola, where we can actually stop it. And for some, like flu, we try to mitigate. We try to reduce the damage.
With Ebola, finding people who have had contact with those infected is critical. Ebola spreads through bodily fluids. Contact has to be close. Coronaviruses are airborne, like measles, which means that these viruses can spread more easily through coughing or sneezing. This makes contact tracing much more difficult. Isolation is also key.
Don't go out if you're sick.
But with a widespread virus that has infected more than 20,000 people, that can be a daunting task. Lauren Sauer, director of the Office of Critical Event Preparedness and Response at Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore, spoke to VOA by Skype.
It's hard. It's definitely a really challenging public health question.
The Chinese government has asked people to self-isolate if they don't need hospital care. The government has also quarantined entire cities, which means people who are there are not allowed to leave. Frieden explains.
In public health terms, we call something social distancing. In other words, reducing the amount of contact among people.
There are other things public health experts recommend repeatedly.
Wash your hands, cover your cough.
Everyone needs to wash their hands. Everyone needs to stay home if they're sick.
We don't have a vaccine for this one, and we probably won't for at least a year.
Researchers are working on a vaccine. But for this virus, the public health practices will likely end the outbreak, whether it reaches pandemic stage or not. It's what ended the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and some other epidemics as well. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And now back to South Sudanese politics. With the February 22nd deadline fast approaching to form a new government, there is still no agreement on the number of states or their boundaries. The chief mediator at the talks aimed at ending the stalemate chaired a six-hour consultative meeting over the matter yesterday, but there was no breakthrough. La Suba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
Henry Oduor, the SPLM IO's deputy chairman, spoke to reporters last night, minutes after the meeting was over.
It is disheartening in that today we hit another big wall, a stumbling block, that we did not come with an agreement that would have given the people of South Sudan the hope that we are going in the right direction.
Information Minister Michael Makuei, one of the government's representatives on the National Pre-Transitional Committee, the body responsible for implementing pre-transitional activities, says despite the party's failure to resolve all outstanding issues, the Kiir administration is not prepared to extend the pre-transitional period yet again.
We are saying there is no more extension. We are saying on the 22nd of February, not on the 22nd, but on the 21st of February, which will be the last day of the 100 days, the government will be declared and it will take oath on the 22nd. If they don't take part, that is a time when we will respond, but not now.
Last month, a regional committee proposed that South Sudan's parties move ahead with forming a unity government by the February 22nd deadline and leave it to an arbitration committee to later resolve the dispute over the number of states and their boundaries. The government initially accepted the arbitration proposal. But yesterday, Makwei said the Kiir administration proposes in a state that a stalemate over states be resolved in a referendum vote after the unity government is formed.
Arbitration is a court whose decision is final and binding and not subject to appeal. So it is even stronger than the ordinary court. So we, as a government, we objected to the arbitration process and we said, let us stick to the provisions of the agreement.
For its part, the SPLM-IO says it now welcomes arbitration to resolve the dispute, but Oduor says arbitration should be carried out before the parties form a unity government. Oduor says unless the long-standing dispute over the number of states is resolved quickly and security arrangements are implemented, the SPLM-IO will not participate in a unity government.
Together with security arrangements, these are the barest minimum. Without these two issues being resolved, we in the opposition, we in IO, we will not come into government. I repeat, if by the 23rd, as His Excellency Makwe says, they establish the vitalized government of national unity, we will not be part of it.
The chief mediator at the talks, South Africa's Deputy President David Mabuza, said his committee is referring the matter to an African Union summit scheduled to take place in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia this weekend, but there is not a lot of time.
Our feeling is that it's too short a time. If we want to do a thorough job, probably we need to consult further. We must consult IGAD, we must consult the C5, we must consult the AU. Fortunately, they've got a summit this weekend. We're going to table the proposal here, and beyond that, we'll come back and give them the feedback.
C5 refers to the five countries that are the guarantors to the revitalized peace agreement: Nigeria, South Africa, Chad, Algeria and Rwanda. President Kiir and SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar were expected to meet on the sidelines of the expected African Union summit this weekend to further discuss the matter. Makwe says he is not sure that will happen.
The president will be going only for the meetings of IGAD and the General Assembly of the AU. He's not going to meet anybody. He has been meeting all the leaders of opposition here.
Under the terms of the existing agreement, the parties have about 2 weeks to complete security arrangements and resolve the state and boundaries issue in order to form a unity government. Last week, the European Union warned the body will soon be compelled to review its policies toward dealing with the parties to the deal should they fail to make significant progress in implementing the RSS. In a tweet earlier this week, Moussa Faki Mohamed, who chairs the African Union Commission, said, quote, "We can no longer stand by at the indescribable cruelty of the violence that belligerents continue to inflict on a population that has suffered far too much for too long. Time has come to impose sanctions on those obstructing peace," end quote. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Kenya has outlawed female genital mutilation, but has the practice stopped? Find out when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you react when you fail?
I just take it easy and I pray for my chance to come again. I calm down my heart. Well, I feel I'm down, but it gives me the strength to work harder or to get another enterprise. If I fail in some line, I achieve that one, then I look for another opportunity.
Not so bad, but I take it as a stepping stone to something bigger. So I don't cry. However, I don't rejoice as much. I just relax and then think of where I made the mistakes and other things and then push myself up.
People don't enjoy failure, but it all helps and motivates and keeps me going, because if I fail, I learn a lot from that and I don't want to repeat that. So anytime I fail, I realize and I go back and correct the mistake that I did.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Kenya banned female genital mutilation, also known as FGM, in 2011, but the tradition has continued in some ethnic communities. President Uhuru Kenyatta vowed to end FGM before 2023, 7 years ahead of a United Nations deadline to stop the practice globally. Activists, however, say more needs to be done as millions of girls are still at the risk of undergoing the cut. Rahel Ombor has more for VOA from Narok, Kenya.
At just 7 years old, Sylvia Case's family told her she would be circumcised, a tradition known as female genital mutilation, FGM, because of the physical damage caused. One day before the ceremony, Case ran away from her home village of Ewasongiro to the town of Narok, a three-hour walk.
I just decided I better run away even if I'm going to die, because I had that motion that how comes my father never took me to school and now he wants to circumcise me. And then, of course, after circumcision and you are not in school, what next? You will get married. So I say I better run away, whether I will get help or not.
The Tasaru Girls Rescue Center gave Case the shelter and support to avoid circumcision and stay in school. The center's 63-year-old founder, Agnes Pareo, has helped more than 1,000 girls escape genital mutilation since 1999. Her mission to protect girls is a personal one, as a family put her through FGM when she was 14 years old.
Because of what I went through, nobody could tell me that FGM was good. I didn't know other effects, but I knew the pain I went through. The bleeding I bled the whole day and nobody cared. They kept talking.
Kenya banned FGM in 2011, but some ethnic groups like the Maasai still see it as a traditional rite of womanhood before marriage. The United Nations say 1 in 5 Kenyan women between 15 and 49 years old have been circumcised. Activists say more needs to be done to reach the UN goal to end FGM worldwide by 2030. Anne Juguna is Plan International's regional disaster and risk management specialist.
It is estimated that around 200 million girls in the world living today, alive today, have undergone one form of FGM or another globally. And it is further estimated that 15 more million girls will undergo FGM by 2030, and these girls are between the ages of 15 and 19 years old. And this is a huge number that we cannot allow to happen.
Activists say more community and family support is needed to end FGM in Kenya. After final high school exams this year, Case plans to return home for the first time in 11 years to reconcile with the family that tried to circumcise her. She wants to share with them her dream of becoming a doctor and show everyone in the village that girls should not be cut and are instead better off in school. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Narok, Kenya.
Human Rights Watch accuses China of developing a mass surveillance system to monitor and control its population. China figures prominently in the agency's annual report, which examines the human rights situation in more than 90 countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The advocacy group's report says the Chinese people are living through the most intense period of repression since the brutal crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square in 1989. It says the Uyghurs in the northwestern region of Xinjiang province are most victimized. It says more than 1 million people are interned in so-called re-education camps in an effort to erase their Muslim heritage and culture, a claim China denies. Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says China is establishing a surveillance system unlike any ever seen before. He says that system is mostly used to keep tabs on the movements of the Uyghurs. He says the system is being developed throughout the country.
This massive database is then used to determine who is detained or not. And police officers on the street have access to that database through their handheld devices. So people stopped at checkpoints can be sent off to detention. People's homes actually have barcodes on them so that the police can quickly figure out, you know, how reliable the residents of this home are.
Roth says China censors all criticism at home and is now using its economic power to globalize its censorship system. He says the government is using its ability to control exports to the Chinese market, which represents 16% of the global economy, to get companies abroad to do its bidding.
They've used that threat of denying access to force companies to start to censor their employees. In other words, it has begun to export its censorship system to move the well-established domestic system of censorship abroad and to apply it to people anywhere in the world who might criticize China.
One of the most notorious cases concerns the U.S. National Basketball Association. China threatened to rip up a $1 billion television contract because of a dispute with the NBA over Hong Kong. Roth says China also uses its influence as a superpower to undermine initiatives it does not like on the diplomatic level. He says China uses its veto power in the United Nations Security Council to stop the UN from addressing dire situations in places such as Syria, Myanmar, and Venezuela. He accuses Beijing of doing whatever it can to undermine UN efforts to enforce human rights. He says China does respond to pressure. Countries have shown when they band together, they can successfully defy China. Roth says China cannot retaliate against all countries because it cannot afford to cut off economic relations with the entire world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
British companies have made bigger profits investing in Africa than in any other region of the world. That's according to a new report from the Overseas Development Institute, which urges firms to seek profits on the continent rather than seeing it as a place to do charitable work. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Britain is looking for new partners, and it's eyeing Africa. With 1.2 billion people and 8 of the world's 15 fastest growing economies, Africa offers world-beating returns on investment, according to a report from the Overseas Development Institute.
In the past 20 years, it's about 16%. And this is much higher than in other countries. Even if you look at returns in Latin America and other developing countries, this case of higher returns in Africa is definitely should encourage more UK investments in the continent.
Britain is playing catch-up. Data from agency the International Trade Center show France and Germany export more than double the value of goods to Africa than Britain does. At a London summit earlier this month, African business leaders said Britain must get proactive post-Brexit.
If the UK just sit down, the vessel will go, the train will move.
UK companies need to come and work with the African business model.
British companies believe they have an edge on technology. The UK Space Agency is backing satellite firms that offer services to African farmers like the PRISE, or Pest Risk Information Service. Chris Castelli is Director of Programs at the UK Space Agency.
So it's taking terabytes of satellite data and sending out text alerts to farmers, which can tell them when pests might become a problem in the future.
African entrepreneurs are seeking investment in homegrown technology. Mobi Health is a mobile app that seeks to offer top-level healthcare access across Africa.
90% of our doctors are from the Western countries, 10% from the rest of Africa. They provide video consultation, prescription, diagnostic test. We are looking here to connect with people who can help us to scale up our business and take this global.
African nations need to work harder to attract investment, says the Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development.
We need to develop this human resource as a contribution to the world's economy, that we need to write the conditions to make Africa the next factory of the world. Then you can say, can Britain step in just like any other friend of Africa and offer some of the solution?
Britain says it can, but many analysts warn negotiations over its future relationship with Europe will dominate trade talks in the coming months and years. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Although there are no confirmed cases of coronavirus in South Sudan, the director of the Juba Teaching Hospital has confirmed to this program that there is one suspected case that has been identified. A Chinese national who exhibited flu symptoms has been quarantined until test results are completed. The World Health Organization has taken samples from the man. Dr. Maker Isaac, director of the Juba Teaching Hospital, says there is no cause for alarm in South Sudan. Dr. Isaac says the tests are being conducted in South Africa. The WHO is holding off on calling the coronavirus outbreak a pandemic, but some infectious disease experts say it could lead to one. The virus has spread to more than two dozen countries, but the vast majority are in China. And finally, parties to the South Sudan peace deal met in Juba for several hours yesterday to try to hammer out a resolution to the stalemate over the number of states and boundaries, but no breakthrough was reported. The SPLM-IO's deputy chairman, Henry Odwar, says it is disheartening that the parties hit another brick wall. Information Minister Michael McQuay says the Kyr administration is not ready to extend the deadline to form a government again. The deadline is February 22nd. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Nina Tabanin by a group from South Sudan.
Yapade anaki kore kalam nasigere bara min bele. Kalamasaki nasketi kere bara min ye. Kalamasaki nasigere bara min tore tore. I know the Juba. I know the Bor. I know the Malaka. Kele daro I know the Morobo. You know the Tikam. Oman Tabani. Congo, Tani ti Kenya, Tani ti Uganda, come on Ababele. Tani nafika tabani, tema shake tati nube. Ya di katulu, taskoba di katulu. Tani di turubu, Tani di tabau. Biu di damiru, jino pin malu. Anina kali kikore nne salam, salam ya, astafani zulu. Kele ni nasibu masakil, asantira babele telina deya. Tulubi, anina kuludamu wahi, kele nasibu masakil de. Katula kwana kuluyo, kemira kwana kuluyo. Anina yalka umawahi, kele nasibu kuluyo.
We've been listening to Jaffa Pro Julius TG with the song Anina Biga Tabanin. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. We invite you to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
You'll be the mirror, you'll be my love.